From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, we remember soul singer Sharon Jones. She died Friday of pancreatic cancer. Jones was 40 when she was discovered by Gabriel Roth, a founder of the soul revival band The Dap Kings.
It reminded me of James Brown and JB's, that music. And then I knew where they was coming from with me singing. I fit right in. I guess I was that female James Brown.
We'll listen back to two interviews with Jones, one in 2007 and one from last July after the release of the documentary Miss Sharon Jones. The film is about the period in 2013 when she was first diagnosed with cancer. By the time of our second interview, the cancer had returned, but she was still performing.
That's my therapy, being on stage. It's like this cancer is here, but I want to perform. I don't want to be home just taking medicine waiting to die.
Also, Maureen Carrigan reviews Michael Chabon's new novel. That's on Fresh Air. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to remember soul singer Sharon Jones, who died last Friday of pancreatic cancer. We have two interviews to play for you. Sharon Jones has been called the female James Brown. She grew up in his hometown, Augusta, Georgia, and imitated him as a child. She became known for fronting the band The Dap Kings. The band's retro soul sound was also heard on several tracks of Amy Winehouse's hit album Back to Black, including the songs Rehab and You Know I'm No Good. My first interview with Sharon Jones was recorded in 2007. Also joining us for that interview was the founder of the Dap Kings, Gabriel Roth, a.k.a. Bosco Mann. He met Jones when he co-owned the now-defunct label Desco Records and asked her to record for it. Roth subsequently co-founded Daptone Records. When we spoke, Daptone Records had just released the third album by Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. Roth produced the album, plays bass on it, and wrote many of the album's songs, including the great title track, 100 Days, 100 Nights.
100 days, 100 nights, to know a man's heart. 100 days, 100 nights, to know a man's heart. And a little more before he knows.
That's Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. Welcome to both of you. How would you describe the sound you're going after?
More of a soul, stacked 68, 69 sound. Okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, I've always just tried to make records that sound like the records I like. I never had too much of a very specific agenda that we were going to try to ape something or try to pass something off. We just wanted to make records that felt good to us and sounded good to us.
James Brown has obviously been a big influence on each of you. I'd like you to each talk about the influence of James Brown on you. Sharon, let's start with you.
Well, with me, just, I guess, being born in his hometown and my parents, I found out later, my mother knew him. When he was out there doing his thing, like in front of the record store, before he owned anything, when he was still dancing and shining shoes and making money, that type of thing, you know, they knew each other from coming up. And my Uncle Willie told me that he was like, my father used to like tap with James Brown, used to dance out on the streets. I was like, wow, you know, so I don't, you know, you never know these things. You know, when the older people get up and they start talking sometime, and I just found all this out like last year. So I'm like, well, I haven't heard this before. So, you know, I'll let that go. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Uncle Willie just wanted to be talking, but, you know, but still, I know that they did grow up. And once he was performing somewhere in Augusta, and I think I was maybe 9, 10, or maybe, you know, younger, and I went to see him, and something happened. He was on the stage, and I looked at his foot, and all I remember saying to my father, I turned around, told someone, like, he's floating. His foot, he's not even touching the floor. And I was, like, right at the stage, eye level to James Brown's feet, and I couldn't tell if that man, it was like he was floating. And that's an experience that I just remember, that experience with James. And then the next was when I saw him last year, April, in Italy, right before, you know. And he was a little weak, and I got to take the picture, and I was trying to get word into him. Oh, Mr. Brown, you know, my name is Sharon Jones with the Dap Kings, and you know. And he was like, looked me right in the eye and said, God bless you, daughter. And, and that was it, and, you know.
Well, while we're talking about James Brown, you know, James Brown was often introduced on stage in this, like, great hyperbolic way. And you I know, have done that on record. I don't know if you do that for all the shows. But why don't we play the introduction from the first Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings album. And this will give a taste of what I mean. Here it comes.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Daptones Super Soul Review. My name is Binky Griptite, and we are the Dap Kings. Thank you very much. Right now, for your enjoyment and pleasure, we would like to introduce to you the funky and dynamic sister who is exciting dance floors across the nation with her dynamic new sound. Soul brothers and sisters from coast to coast, get up and get down whenever her records are played. They're doing all the funky new dances. They're doing the bump and touch. They're doing the dap dip. Everything. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm talking about 110 pounds of soul excitement coming for you. This sister is so bad, she's badder than bad. I'm talking about the same sister that brought you such hits as The Landlord. Damn, it's hot. Ain't it hot? Bam! And now, ladies and gentlemen, the star of our show, the super soul sister with the magnetic je ne sais quoi, Miss Sharon Jones!
That's the introduction from the first Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings album. God, can you guys do that for me, like when I host Fresh Air? that would just be so great to have that kind of introduction.
I'll tell you, you got to hire Binky Griptite, man. Binky Griptite has been a very integral part of our whole operation for the last, dozen years. He's a great guitar player, but just as far as showmanship, he's kind of the guy that, as an MC, kind of brings the show to another level as far as our live show, But as far as the live show, it is really influenced not just by James Brown, but by Stax and all the other kind of soul reviews that were going on in the late 60s. There's a sense of showmanship in that and excitement that you don't see in a lot of shows nowadays.
Well, let's hear another song. Another song from the new Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings album, 100 Days, 100 Nights. And this is called When the Other Foot Drops, Uncle. And Gabe, you wrote this. Do you want to say a few words about the song?
Yeah, it's actually funny because I didn't think it was that obscure, but people have thought this song was about some guy that's not treating Sharon right. But it's actually a little political. Uncle, When the Other Foot Drops, Uncle, it's about Uncle Sam. It's just a song about all the lies and corruption kind of eventually catching up, and the other shoe dropping, and obviously, when you say Uncle Sam, you're talking about, Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and all these things. And these guys finally going to get caught up in all these lies about everything, about weapons of mass destruction and oil money and the rest. I mean, but that's what the song's about. And I think if you listen to it in that light, you hear the lyrics a little differently.
Sharon, did you know that was what it was about when you were singing it?
Not really. So that's why I'm just going to say, get out of here. My mouth is open. I'm looking at him like, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, people, they've asked me about that song. I say, well, it's just about somebody's being slick and they're going to get caught up in what they're doing, their lies and whatever they're doing is being caught up. So now it's good. So when I get interviewed, people ask me, I don't know what to say.
Yeah, there's a line in that song about your crafty little pencil. Running out of lead, and everybody thinks that's some kind of impotency thing.
So Sharon, what do you mean about the little crafty little pencil? I'm like, that's really Gabe wrote the song. Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I have to say that's what I thought it meant, and the crafty little pencil thing. And I thought I was going to ask you, Gabe, like, uncle. I mean, like, this isn't a relationship with her uncle, is it? So I was a little confused. So thanks.
Yeah, that's actually why we stuck that uncle on the end of the title.
Yeah.
It kind of hung that on there at the end. It was like, well, here you go.
I thought this was some kind of like expression that only I didn't get.
I tell you, it makes a lot more sense than Goo Goo Gachoo, I guess. So.
I'll give you that. Well, it's a great song no matter how you want to interpret it. So here it is, When the Other Foot Drops, Uncle. It's Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings.
Oh, the way you lie. To get your taste, uncle. Oh, the things you let to waste. But every dog has his day, uncle. And it just can't go on. It just can't go on this way. For the day will surely
you're gonna pay for all your dimes. There won't be nowhere to run. You're gonna be found out. Yeah. You can bet you're gonna lose your cloud. You've been tramping around this world like you're the only one living. But soon enough, you're gonna get back some of what you've been giving. The lies that you've been spinning up are running out of thread. And your crafty little pencil is running out of lead.
That's Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. We're listening back to a 2007 interview with soul singer Sharon Jones and Gabriel Roth, a founder of the band the Dap Kings, which she sang with. Jones died last Friday of cancer. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to a 2007 interview with soul singer Sharon Jones, who died last Friday of cancer. Also in this interview is Gabriel Roth, a founder of the band The Dap Kings, which she performed with. So, Sharon, I know you spent some time as a prison guard at Rikers Island. How did you get the job?
I took the test. I took a lot of tests at that time. I took the police test.
What's the test Senate. Like? I mean, what you really need to do is to be able to, you know,
get
people to respect you. How do you pass a test on that?
Well, they give you a psychological test, you know, the physical test you have to go through, a little background check on you, you know. Mm-hmm. It was great. I think I would have still been there, but it just took me away from my singing, you know, the music. It was like a career. And after being in there, it was like an omen. My first week, they stuck me outside, and I pulled a groin muscle on the side. I fell. Then I came back, and I was in a, believe it or not, it's so weird, a car accident. A truck hit me, and I was out for another, like, 9 months. And they forced me back to work. And at the same day I came to work, I had a back brace, a neck brace, you know, and I'm walking on and fell on the curb. So now I'm injured again.
No.
But now it's, I'm telling you, it wasn't meant for me. I fell on the job. Now it's comp, and I'm out again for another couple of months. And so when I finally came in, they said, you know, the lawyer said, why don't you just resign? This way they won't fire you. And so I resigned for medical reasons.
So how many days did you actually work?
Okay, I'll say out of the 2 years, from 88 to 90, maybe 6-8 months.
So when you were there, given how you kept injuring yourself and you weren't in the best physical shape, how were you able to convince the prisoners that you were strong enough and focused enough to do the job and keep them in line?
Let me tell you, if the look in my eyes, you may have like 80 inmates to maybe three officers or two officers. So it was really weird, but you could not show fear. And that's one thing I didn't show, you know, and I got the respect from them right there. And they knew that I didn't take stuff. I wasn't scared.
Let's hear another track from Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. And this song is called Humble Me. And this is another song, Gabe, that you wrote. Do you want to say anything about writing or recording this track?
Well, it's a very simple song. There wasn't much to write. It's just a couple of chords and some simple, heartfelt words that Sharon could really get into. I mean, the thing that I learned about writing is that, you know, I've never been a genius or anything, but I learned how to kind of get out of the way of great musicians and great singers. So, you know, if you listen to the song, there's not much to the writing in it, but I think Sharon puts a lot of heart into it, you know.
Actually, I think that song, you was writing something about me, the inside of me, but I think, you know, by knowing me all these years, Gabe knew that how I am at the church. I'm always saying, you know, I'm so thankful for what God gave me. So that's why I'm always saying, if you see me like I'm higher than everybody else, you know, bring me down. Let me know I'm not. If you see me up here wanting all these here fancy things, which, you know, they don't never see me out here flashing and wanting stuff. But if you see me doing that, I want all these shoes that cost $2,000, $3,000. Think about that man over there who don't even have the foot is cut off, you know, don't even have legs, you know. And then I'm also thankful, humble for when I'm on the road. People come out and pay to come and see me. And I get on that stage, and I'm humble for them coming out to see me every night. And I'm so thankful for them, for God, for having me to be able to dance and jump and sing and keep my voice open. So that song is just about me thanking God, being humble for my blessings.
All right. Well, here it is. Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, Humble Me, from their new CD, 100 Days, 100 Nights. That's Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, and with me in the studio is Sharon Jones and Gabe Roth, who's co-founder of the Dap Kings, leader of the band, writer of most of the songs, including the one we just heard, and bass player. So one more question before we have to end. I haven't had the pleasure of seeing you on stage, only of listening to the recording, so what do you look like, all of you, on stage? How do you dress? I mean, some of the solo reviews you're talking about, like, really loud clothes.
I don't think it's loud, but you good, Gabe. You tell them. Come on.
Well, no, we keep it sharp. Everybody's got suits and ties and shine shoes and locked in step, man. The horn section's got some unbelievable steps. The band is always stepping together and playing together. And Sharon always looks unbelievable. She comes out and is usually a blur from the beginning of the show to the end. You've never seen something move so much. So visually, it's definitely an event, too.
I guess those injuries from your prison guard days aren't holding you back.
No, they're not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks to both of you for talking with us. It's really been fun. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
My interview with singer Sharon Jones and Gabriel Roth, a founder of the Dap Kings, was recorded in 2007. Jones died of cancer last Friday. We'll hear the interview I recorded with Jones last July, in which we talked about the cancer and other things, after we take a short break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I've been laying alone for hours, but I haven't slept at all. But I'm listening for your call, for your call. These feet
to crawl, but these arms are strong enough to hold you. If you call, if you call, am I dead? Come cut my heart out, 'cause it hardly beats at all. But please, please leave a little potion just in case my baby calls. If you call.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Whole Foods Market, offering the flavors of the season, from organic turkeys and broths to peak season produce and ready-to-eat options. Holiday recipes available at WFM.com/holiday. And from Carbonite, for backing up and restoring office and home computers to the cloud automatically. Learn more at Carbonite.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're remembering soul singer Sharon Jones. She died last Friday of pancreatic cancer. She was 60 years old. The second interview we're going to hear with her was recorded last July when a documentary about her was released called Miss Sharon Jones. The film was shot in 2013, during the first 7 months after her initial diagnosis of stage 2 pancreatic cancer, a period in which she had extensive surgery and chemo treatments. The film ends with her return to the stage. That was followed by a world tour with the band The Dap Kings, the band that always recorded and performed with her. That tour was pretty remarkable, considering what she'd been through. But by the time I interviewed her in July, the cancer had returned. She'd gotten a chemo treatment the day before our interview. Sharon Jones, welcome back to Fresh Air. Can I start by asking you how your health is now?
You know, I'm on and off. I take it one day at a time. And being on the stage with performing and opening up for Hall & Oates for the last 2.5 weeks. And then doing 3 nights in a row, 1 day off, three. So I did like 9 straight nights and a day off in between there. So, but I feel pretty good.
That is an insane schedule when you're in chemo. That's just insane.
That's my therapy, being on stage. You know, I mean, it's like this cancer is here, and I would have to take the chemo, but I want to perform. I don't want to be home just taking medicine and waiting to die. You know, that's not something I'm about. So as long as I got my health and the energy, my voice is great. So there's nothing wrong vocally. I just want to be able to get on stage and move around.
So making a documentary about you after you were diagnosed with cancer in 2013, that was the idea of your manager, Alex. What did you initially think of the idea? And forgive me for asking something so straightforwardly.
Excuse me.
But if I were you, I probably wouldn't know whether this was going to end up as an obituary or a triumphant return to the stage.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think once Barbara Coppola took it on and the band, my goal was to, I had a February date, and my goal was to be back at that date. And everything in the filming and there's a scene with the church scene, that was my first time even attempt to sing after months. And that's when I knew from the church scene that I was ready. I was going to be ready for February. I knew I was going to have the strength. And doing the film was also my therapy. And I knew that it would help someone out there with cancer or going through it, as long as I inspired someone, because that's where my health came from. My energy came from knowing my fans was out there and I'm getting back to them, and I wanted them to see me go what I'm going through with.
The impression I take away from the film is that you had a great feeling of responsibility for the band, because the band is centered around you. You know, there's horns and drummer and, you know, guitarist and everything, but, like, you're the singer, you're the focal point. So if you're not there, the band's kind of out of work. And
it's not only, it's not only the band, it's the whole, management, my whole, you know, we got publishers,
right.
We got, it's so much, you know, it's a whole big, we got an LLC, it's a company here.
Mm-hmm.
And so with a lot of people not getting paid, including myself, and one of the doctors wasn't included in insurance, so we had to pay out of the pocket money for, you know, so it was, and believe it or not, I didn't know what was going on with one of my members. Thank God they kept that away from me. But I found out on that the night I watched the film for the first time in Canada.
Wait, what didn't you know about?
Like Binky going through the divorce and then, losing stuff. And like
guitarist.
Gabe not being able to get the loan, and just different people in the band, you know, lost apartments and, you know, had to move in. So it was a lot that they didn't put that on me, you know. But I found out about it later, you know, in the filming, so. But I had already knew I had to get back out there, and I knew we had to. You know, our money is when we work.
Well, why don't we hear another recording? And this is from an album. You had to hold back an album when you got sick. And the album
was... Give the People What They Want.
Yeah, the album's called Give the People What They Want. And there's a track from it that's on the soundtrack from the new documentary about you. The documentary is called Miss Sharon Jones. And so here's a song from the soundtrack, and it's called People Don't Get What They Deserve.
When I was a child, I believed what they told me.
Everyone.
To each one shall come what each one shall earn. And if I worked hard, nobody could hold me. And cheaters will fail, that's what they all. Sweat of other men's labor. As he sips his champagne and lays in the sun.
That's my guest, Sharon Jones, singing People Don't Get What They Deserve from the soundtrack of the new documentary, Miss Sharon Jones, which was directed by Barbara Coppel. And that featured the Dap Kings, the band that backs her. You watched a lot of TV when you were sick, but you don't say anything in the film about listening to a lot of music. Did you listen to
I didn't.
How come?
Because I couldn't sing. I couldn't get air, because people didn't realize I was cut across the diaphragm all the way up from right under the center under my breast all the way down to top of my navel.
So you can only listen to music when you can sing?
Well, I didn't want to. I was just down. I mean, here I am not performing. I've been working almost 20 years on the stage, and here it is these months. I went from May to actually September when you saw me in that church sing. It was the first time I sang in months, you know, and then I had to get prepared to do the Thanksgiving Day parade in November. You know, I had to get out there and lip sync. Even though I lip sync, I still had to be up and be around, you know.
So you mentioned the church. There's a scene in the documentary Miss Sharon Jones when you go to a church in Queens, New York, and you sing His Eye Is on the Sparrow. And it's a really nice scene. I thought we could listen to you singing that. And this is, as you said, this is the first time that you sang after getting the surgery and starting chemo. So why don't we hear that?
Okay.
And then we'll talk.
Again, I just want to give honor to God. And right now I'm going to try to sing a little bit of His Eyes on a Sparrow. And I sing because
you were not holding back.
No, I was letting it all out, and I was, you know, and it's, that's a difference. And anointing came over me. I just opened my mouth, and they just come out, you know, and the air just flowed. And that was, like I said, from that thing, I knew that God had watched over me, and he had me ready. I was going to be ready for February.
Why did you choose that song to be the first song and to be the song that you sang in this small neighborhood church?
Because if he watches over a little sparrow, you know, if he take care of the birds, a little sparrow, here I am, one of his children, you know. We got so many of us down here, human beings that send our faith up and believe. And if he watch over a sparrow, I know he watches over me. And that was the song. And it was about I'm singing, you know, because I'm happy. And I'm free. When I get in church and I sing, and I mean, singing is my life. And when I can do that, that's when I'm free. That's when I'm at my happiest. I'm at my most.
What was the importance of the church in your early singing life?
I think it just prepared me for what to come out here. I mean, it prepared me for when I was told I didn't have what it took, which I knew I was a singer. But y'all was looking, they was looking for looks and style. And
right, you were told you were too short and too black.
Too
and
fat, yeah,
too fat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I just, I didn't make it there with that. The younger, you know, when I was in that youth in my late 20s, 30s, and 40 was my first album I got a chance to record. And the reason why I got a chance to record that, because we built our record label and started Daptone. And then they finally got a label so I can have an album out, dap dipping, and we don't have to worry about if I sold 5 or 5,000 or 500. The record label wasn't gonna fold under or fire me because I didn't sell, you know, a million records or whatever. So we started that so we can do our music the way we wanted to and get me out there.
Since we just heard you sing in church, tell us about the early churches that you sang in when you were a girl.
One of my churches was in the South. South Carolina, right across the bridge from Augusta, Georgia. But that was the church my first time ever attempting to sing for the Nativity Christmas play. I played an angel, and I got to sing Silent Night. And I was like maybe 8, 9 years old, and I remember, you know, doing that, and I was like, and those people, that little girl can sing. And I think right then and there I knew that I was going to be a singer. You know, God had blessed me with a gift to sing.
Did you sing in choirs or did you usually sing solo?
Well, at that time, I was young. I just sang with my sister. My sister Willa, we used to sing a little duet like, take the love with you. Oh, and she'd take a verse and I'll take a verse. And And, you know, that's how I was just going from there. You know, and then later on in the church in New York, I started going to that church at 14, and I just directed choirs. I never took any kind of vocal lessons or teachings of how to. I never even took piano lessons, and a voice just came to me and said, go play the piano in church. And I I followed my bass player and my guitar player, and I just started playing piano with two fingers, and I just started playing my chords, and that's where I'm at. And listening to Aretha, who was my biggest inspiration, and when I saw her on the Amazing Grace album, and she had that dashiki on, and she was did this song, Mary, Don't You Weep, and that was one of the songs. I said, I'm going to play this piano. And I can actually play a couple of Aretha songs, but only can play gospel on the piano and stuff. But that was a big, and Mary, Don't You Weep was one of my songs that I learned how to play and sing of Aretha Franklin.
We're listening to the interview I recorded last July with soul singer Sharon Jones. She died last Friday of pancreatic cancer. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, supporting the American Lung Association's Lung Force. Patients, caregivers, and families can share their stories of inspiration at lungforce.org or with the StoryCorps app, keyword lung cancer. And from Baird, providing global financial resources and market expertise to clients the world over. rwbaird.com has more information.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I recorded in July with soul singer Sharon Jones after the release of a documentary about the first 7 months after her diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. By the time we spoke, the cancer had returned, and she was back on chemo. She died last Friday at age 60. In the documentary, you say that you feel like a different person than you were before you got sick, and that when you started performing again, you basically wanted to figure out who you were. Who was this new Sharon Jones, and who was this new Sharon Jones going to be on stage? So do you feel like you've been able to answer that for yourself as a performer?
Yeah, the night I went out there, it was like, it was a different Sharon because the hair is gone. That energy, I mean, everyone said my energy was great, but I didn't feel it all. Like Binky always said, 110 pounds of soul. I felt like that night, maybe I gave like 90 of it or, you know, a little less. And even now, the days on the stage, I'm just not myself. I don't have that energy. And the legs doesn't lift up like I want to with the pain. The neuropathy from certain chemo is like, it's a hinder. But I do the shows, but it's not the same.
Right. Because you, for anybody who hasn't seen you perform, you do a lot of dancing and jumping around on stage. You are not still. So I could see how it would be very difficult to do that with neuropathy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's some nights it's tough, like I said, and to get past that pain and you know, and each night it seems like once Binky say, Miss Sharon Jones, and I walk out there, all the nerves gone, all the nervousness and the pain, you know, I fight through it. You know, those first couple of seconds or the first 5 minutes, it's, you know, is the most that I can get through it.
I have to say, though, there's a point in the movie where you say, if it comes to a point where you have to sing while sitting in a chair or on a stool, that's when you're going to retire. And I thought, that's ridiculous. I mean, there's so many singers I love, like jazz singers, who spent so much of their career just sitting in a chair or sitting on a stool singing. And, like, that was great for me. I mean, I love your voice. Like, why wouldn't you just sing sitting down if you needed to?
Well, I guess I'm going to have to if something like that happened the way you just went. I'm like, okay.
I mean, really, like, don't retire if you end up having to sit down and sing.
Maybe then I'll hire some dancers to come out and start dancing around the stage.
Fine. I want to go back a little bit to your very early singing career. Before you made it as a singer with the Dap Kings, doing your songs, doing the songs that mm-hmm. were really for you, you sang in a wedding band. Did you do covers?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's all we did was covers in the wedding band. I did a lot of Whitney. I did Aretha. You know, that was my thing. You know, I had that hype, you know, and we did that. And then we would go into, like, the oldies, and I would do stuff like, each night before you go to bed, my baby, you know, and stuff like that, and go into dancing in the street and, you know, we just jammed stuff, man. We was a different wedding band. And now it's weird because I would like to see people, because they had 8 tracks back in those days, a little cassette track 8. I would like to see some of that stuff. I wonder if people said, oh, my God, look, she did my wedding.
Is it especially great to have backup singers with you? I mean, how many girls dream of, you know, like being the lead singer or being a backup singer, but doing that, you know, just having the power that comes with having backup singers, the vocal power.
Backup singers are such an important role. Except I'm just a background singer. No, you're not just a background singer. That's why you call it background. You're keeping that back and you're grounded. I mean, we all in that band, every one of us is important to us when we become the band. We say Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, that's who we are. And we're a group. And backup, you know, we did the Learn the Hard Way album. And, you know, you go in the studio. Some of the first early recording, I did a lot of the backgrounds myself, you know, tripled up on them. And then later we would get a couple of singers in, and I still would sing with them, too. I would be third person in that backing up of the album. But Sandra and Star have been singing so long together, the three of us. And after going on the road with I Learned the Hard Way, and No Harm, I have, you know, Binky and Gabe and Fernando, my conga player. They're like, oh, don't worry. We do the background for you. And, you know, Fernando have that little accent. And so we went on the road, and I'm hearing, I learned the hard way. I learned the hard way, baby. I'm like, oh, my God. We're going to get some background singers right now. And so we would start traveling. They would hire some, you know, like if we go over in Europe, over in Australia, they had some sisters that got them. We'd be in the States. I said, look, we got to get somebody that's permanent. And along came Sandra and gave them, like, this would be good for Sharon. She needs this, you know, and I'm back out there on that road. And there you go.
Sharon Jones, it's just been great to talk with you.
Well, I'm going to keep on keeping on as long as I got my health and strength and God give me that will to do it.
Sharon Jones recorded last July. She died of pancreatic cancer last Friday at age 60. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Michael Chabon's new novel, inspired by his grandfather's life story. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of the new novel by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Chabon. It's called Moonglow, and it's loosely based on his grandfather's life. Chabon's other novels include The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, Wonder Boys, and The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay.
The deathbed scene. Literature provides no greater opportunity for melodrama, windy speeches, and schmaltz than the moment when a character who's fading away fast decides to use precious last breaths to talk. The morbid Victorians, in particular, loved these set pieces. Dickens' Little Nell, Kathy in Wuthering Heights, Helen Burns in Jane Eyre. All of them went a-gabbing into their good nights. But Michael Chabon, for all his expansive storytelling gifts, is no Victorian. His latest novel, Moonglow, may be structured around the sentimental situation of a dying grandfather telling the secrets of his life to his grandson. But these stories, dozens of them chopped and scrambled, are bawdy and moving, violent and very funny. It's as though the unnamed grandfather here is like Scheherazade, holding off death through an extended bout of yakking. Michael Chabon has said that Moonglow was inspired by a week-long visit he paid to his own dying grandfather in Oakland, California in 1989. Given that the unnamed narrator here is also a novelist, and that this marathon deathbed scene takes place in Oakland, California, we readers are meant to understand that Chabon is tossing together autobiographical truth and the lies of fiction. Indeed, he tells us as much in a prefatory author's note that warns, tongue-in-cheek, that he's taken liberties with the truth with due abandon. This is also one of those novels that features lists and footnotes. I have to tell you that as a reader, I have limited stamina for this kind of thing unless it's done really well, meaning the novelist remembers to entertain the reader as much as they're entertaining themselves. Chabon does it really well. Granted, some subplots seem self-indulgently baroque. Did the teenage grandfather's first sexual encounter have to be with a bearded lady in a railroad yard? But Chabon's narrative energies never flag. He had me on page one with his opening story of how his grandfather was arrested in 1957 for attempting to strangle his boss at the Feathercombs Barrette Company in New York City. Turns out, the grandfather, a salesman, had just been fired in order to open up a position for Alger Hiss, who'd just been released from prison after serving time for perjuring himself about his involvement with a Soviet spy ring. Barrettes and Alger Hiss? You can't make this stuff up, right? Or maybe only a writer like Chabon can. What ensues, and this is a highly pruned plot summary, is a grand story that hops around from the grandfather's juvenile delinquent childhood in Philadelphia to his service in World War II, working in an Army intelligence unit that was hunting down rocket scientist Wernher von Braun in Germany. This life review also includes the grandfather's marriage to a Holocaust survivor, a woman prodded into insanity by nightmare visions of a skinless horse, to his final days hunting down a pet-eating python in his Florida retirement community. These and a multitude of other subplots command attention because they're so highly textured and because Chabon's language is so voluminous and vivid. At the center of this whirlwind of a novel, there's a long, still passage where the narrator and his dying grandfather talk about the point of it all, of life. Here's a snippet of that powerful conversation, beginning with the grandfather's words. You try to take advantage of the time you have. That's what they tell you to do. But when you're old, you look back and you see all you did with all that time is waste it. All you have is a story of things you never started or couldn't finish. I'm ashamed of myself. I'm not ashamed of you, I said. I'm proud. My grandfather made another one of his faces. This face said that what I knew about shame, what my entire generation, with its deployment of confession as a tool for self-aggrandizement, knew about shame, would fit into half a pistachio shell. Yeah, this is why you read Michael Chabon. for the self-deprecation and insight and brio, all packed tight into sentences, fantastic stories, and wild novels that you may think are a world away from where you live, but always turn out to hit home.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Michael Chabon's new novel, Moonglow. Tomorrow, we celebrate Thanksgiving by listening back to interviews with two American music icons, Johnny Cash and Ray Charles. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Mooj Zadie. I'm Terry Gross.
It brings a tear into my eyes. My pouring tears are running wild.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Home Instead Senior Care, offering customized in-home senior care services from bathing and medication reminders to Alzheimer's care. More at homeinstead.com/NPR. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the belief that all lives have equal value, and working with partners to help envision a world where every person has the opportunity to live a healthy, productive life at gatesfoundation.org.